I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, famous quotes, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous hosts, and other listeners, join our Facebook group, the Raven Puff Common Room.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we're covering Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, Chapter 11, Quidditch, and Chapter 12, The Mirror of Erised. In these chapters, Harry nearly dies during his first Quidditch match and receives an unexpected gift for Christmas. So, Jess, what were your first impressions and thoughts?
I'm really glad you said the mirror of, say that again?
Erised.
Erised. Okay. I really liked that chapter. A lot of cool things happened. It was Christmas. Now I kind of like, since I know a little bit, well, let's be honest. I haven't really seen a full Harry Potter Halloween yet. So, but the Quidditch chapter, it was interesting. I think, you know, when we talked to Amanda and Kevin last week, they mentioned the Quidditch chapters and some people being super into them, some people kind of not. I'm going to fall into the not category. It's just, it's, you know, it's fine and some important things happen, but I prefer the scary libraries more.
Indeed. Again, I'm in the middle where I enjoy it, and, you know, for the most part, I like to think of within a series, like at least 50%, if not more, if there's a Quidditch chapter, the Quidditch match has some relevancy to the plot. It's not just some stupid teenage subplot of, oh, the house rivalries. Like, it serves an actual purpose where some serious stuff actually happens.
Yeah, there are some very important things, and they're setting some very important things up here, specifically with Snape. I had a bias, but I don't know. It was fine. I'm not complaining. It was fine. It was short. It was a really short chapter.
Indeed. And so it starts off with, as they entered November, the weather turned very cold. The mountains around the school became icy gray and the lake like a chilled steel. Every morning, the ground was covered in frost. Hagrid could be seen from the upstairs windows defrosting broomsticks on the Quidditch field, bundled up in a long moleskin overcoat, rabbit fur gloves, and enormous beaver skin boots. So yeah, this, as we were just discussing before recording, this is the weather we are currently dealing with right now.
I would love to be that bundled up. I mean, I don't know. I had to be outside for a little bit today, and I was like, I am so grateful. I don't deliver packages. I'm not a post, you know, office worker. You know, I don't deliver mail. I couldn't deal unless I was dressed as Hagrid was here.
Yeah, and again, it's just funny that this weather in the book is about November, because we're, I don't know about you in Kansas City, but for us in where we are in Indiana, November and December are very, very mild months, and then only in January and February do all the snow and the storms come.
That's it. Ours is, you know, our weather is so moody. Like, I just feel like we never know. We can't have a barometer. I mean, I remember being a kid, and I grew up in the middle of Kansas, and it snowing and canceling Halloween, which was devastating. But we just never know around here. It's just, I feel like that. I feel like everybody makes this like silly joke about the weather, but wherever they are, I don't know. I know I'm not loving the degree weather. My husband and I talk about living in Alaska a lot, and this is always a little reminder, like, maybe not. Maybe not.
Mm. So it's getting colder at Hogwarts, and the Quidditch season has begun, and Harry's basically, when he's not doing his homework, he's spending all of his time practicing, you know, being their new seeker, and Hermione let him borrow Quidditch throughout the ages, and we have an interesting fact of Harry learned that there were 700 ways of committing a Quidditch foul, and that all of them had happened during a World Cup match in 1473. And I just found that interesting because deep Harry Potter trivia, I don't exactly know exactly when the date for like when the Ministry of Magic was formed or when like the Statute of Secrecy was formed and all that, but it wasn't as early as this. So it goes to show you how much humanity and wizards by extension love their sports, because they had formalized their sports relations before their like actual sovereign governmental relations.
I'm so glad you pointed that out, because I was like, I feel like that was a very deliberate, like, 1473, what in the world happened during 1473, other than apparently all these Quidditch balls, so.
Yeah, I have no idea 1473. All I know is that 1453, Constantinople fell to the Turks. And then Hermione had become a bit more relaxed about breaking rules. And so she's showing this by conjuring what's probably not the most legal type of magical fire and carrying it around with her in a jam jar. And I just thought that's so dope.
That is pretty dope. I also like, this is, I'll just read it. Hermione had become a bit more relaxed about breaking the rules since Harry and Ron had saved her from the mountain troll, and she was much nicer for it. So we've warmed up Ron and Harry to Hermione a little bit here. Everybody's kind of pretty happy with each other. I mean, they kind of have a nice, happy friendship at this point. And then also carrying around blue fire, which is pretty badass and reminds me of Game of Thrones a little bit.
Yeah, I just like in fantasy series, because, you know, different colors of fire, because my favorite experiment, like in science class, was when you use different elements to change the color of fire.
Oh, man, you went to a more fun science class than I did. I never got to do that.
No, I think this was in biochemistry that we did this. And so basically, I can't remember each element and, you know, which element you use to get certain colors. But certainly, like, blue fire just symbolizes a fire that's extremely, extremely hot, which is why you see it's blue, like, on gas stoves and like things like that.
Okay.
The only thing I remember is that you use potassium and you can make the fire bright violet purple.
Oh, well, that would be pretty. Purple's my favorite.
So they're all huddled up together trying to get warm with their little fire, and Snape comes lurking about, and Snape is limping. And
yeah.
What's that you've got there, Potter? And then Harry shows him the library book and he's like, "Library books are not to be taken outside the school," said Snape. "Give it to me. 5 points from Gryffindor." Okay, have you ever come across this rule in a library or with books in your life?
I feel like the library books are purposefully, most of them, supposed to be taken out of the library. Now, I've mentioned my friend works at the Folger Shakespeare Library. A lot of books can't be taken out of there, but I don't think this is the case. How? Did you have a story around that? I'm sorry.
No, it's just, again, I totally think Harry is right that Snape is just being spiteful for the sake of it. And I can understand, again, if you have these really ancient, like, books and manuscripts that naturally you have to handle them with gloves, you don't take them outside. But not just, like, a quote-unquote normal library book. Because there was once where I really needed this one book for a paper that I was writing. And it was about, like, Islamic calligraphy, and it wasn't at the normal library at Indiana University. I had to go to the special fine arts library, and I thought I could just check it out like any other book, but literally, that wasn't the case. Like, you could only, like, have it for, like, 2-hour intervals, and you could literally only just take it off the shelf and, like, look at it for a few hours, and I'm like, bitch, this is not a manuscript. This is not something fancy. It was a normal, like, academic book that had been published relatively recently, so I could not understand why I could not just take it out and use it for my paper like a normal library book.
Yeah, well, I mean, it just sounds like you had a Snape situation there. Somebody was just making up some rules to be not nice, basically.
Mm-hmm. And that's just interesting. You know, we learn why Snape is limping, because Harry tries to get the book back and he sees, you know, Snape's mangled leg. And I'm just thinking, from future books, we know that Snape is a very powerful wizard. So it makes me think that there's something somewhat magical in Fluffy's, the three-headed dog's, bite that is more than just physical, that would leave a wizard like Snape still impaired to that degree.
So he has, like, some sort of venom, maybe?
I don't know necessarily venom is the right word for it, but yeah, just something that either something super powerful that makes that can knock down a wizard, even like Snape, for a few days, or Snape is just trying to be very secretive about what he's doing, again, going to Filch rather than maybe going to Madame Pomfrey, who probably maybe could have healed it much more quickly.
That's a interesting thought. Snape is snaping. I don't know what he's...
Yeah, and he's just... And he's so mad when Harry sees him and just screams, get out, get out. And, you know, now he's realizing that he was trying to get past the dog while everyone was distracted with the troll. And Hermione's like, but he's a teacher. He would never do something like that. And then... Ron's like, honestly, Hermione, you'd think all teachers are saints or something, snapped Ron.
I love that, because I feel like there it's a little bit of, I understand that sentiment, just kind of like misunderstanding authority figures, humanity at a young age, for me as a muggle, as a wizard, I can understand like there's some sort of, you know, there, like you said, Snape's a very powerful wizard. So there's some respect there, and there's nothing wrong with respect, but Ron kind of calling Hermione out, like these people are capable of doing some not so nice stuff. So, you know, just calm down,
friend. Yeah, and it's just the naivete. Well, and again, just the sort of self-preservation denial bit of you want the people in power to be forces for good, and just the implications that if they're not forces for good and they have power to do things.
Right. Yeah.
A lot Which is why I think a lot of people wanted to like paint Ivanka Trump and her husband as this sort of mitigating force against the mad king of Donald Trump. And I'm just like, they don't know what the hell they're doing either.
Oh, man. No. If anything, they're like, I mean, no, they're not worse. They're enabling his madness. I can't stand it.
And then, so finally we get that little bit with Snape, and then we get the big Quidditch match.
Big old Quidditch match. The first action beyond the practice that we see.
Indeed, it's like Harry's little debutante ball.
Yeah, which then it's like, again, like debutante ball, like they're, he's kind of like the secret. They're trying to keep him low key. I mean, everybody knows, they mentioned that he's like their secret weapon, but it's not really a secret. So he's big debut here.
Yeah. And again, we don't have to go into the play by play. Yeah. I can agree with, again, there is stuff relevant to the plot, but we do get a few pages of that's purely the game, which is understandable. Again, this is the first book, the first Quidditch match ever, but after reading it so many times, it's just like, yeah, I don't care.
I see the points, and I see the, I appreciate the action. I appreciate for what it does.
Which, if you had to play Quidditch, what position would you want to play?
Whew, I would not be a seeker. I am not small and fast. I think that I would is it a beater? I don't know, man. A beater is like the defender, right?
Like Fred and George beating those cannonballs away from their team.
That sounds like kind of fun to me. So yeah. that would be the position I lead. What about you?
I would probably be a chaser, the most simplest equivalent of, you know, just running around trying to score points.
Well, so we have part of our team. Though I will say, I am not going to ever participate in real life Quidditch. That sounds terrifying.
After what Amanda told you?
Yes, exactly. Yes. No.
Again, I will only do it if our technology advances enough where we actually can do real Quidditch.
I mean, like, I'll fly around. I'll just, like, observe. But I could... This is all too intense for me, and it gets pretty intense for Mr. Harry Potter here pretty quickly.
So yeah, and then we get Harry again trying to find the snitch, but the most important thing that happens during the game is that Harry's broom starts going out of control and is starting to try and buck him off like a horse. Again, makes me think of all these horse and comparisons.
Yes. And they immediately place blame on Snape.
But why?
Because he's, like, saying something under his breath that looks like he's chanting something to, like, bewitch Harry's broomstick.
Exactly. And that's even enough for Hermione to get over her, like, innate bias towards professors and be like, oh, crap, what do we do? And so Hermione's got a thing for fire.
That's awesome. Yeah, she like lights his robe on fire to get him to stop, right?
Yeah, basically, she gets him, doesn't even watch where she's going, knocks over someone like Quirrell or whatever. Yeah, and it takes, and because Snape is so deeply concentrated, it takes a good 30 seconds for him to realize that he's on fire.
This is all suspect to me, but I really don't think, like, I mean, and again, this is me not knowing where things are going or not really remembering where specific plot points are going. First of all, I want to make a comment about Hermione. She has gone from like 0 to 100. Like, she's been very like, oh, follow the rules, to the point where she's lighting a teacher's robe on fire. Like, that's intense. But the other thing, it just seems too obvious. I don't think that like Snape is trying to throw this Quidditch match. I feel like that would be something that would get you kicked out of Hogwarts as a teacher.
They'll probably get you arrested.
Yeah. It seems a little extreme. I mean, like, he's a dick and he obviously doesn't like Harry, but I feel like that's also, is he really gonna like knock the boy who lived off his broom? I don't know. So I just kind of was like, there's something else going on here, and it's not Snape, but it also kind of, you know, gives the kids an opportunity to feel like they're a little powerful.
Certainly, if Snape is doing it, he's certainly not going to do it just to, like, throw a Quidditch match, like, so that his, like, house can win. Like, I'm sure he would have a deeper motivation than that.
I feel like McGonagall, based on what I know and her love of Quidditch, maybe, like, I don't think she'd risk it that much, but she might do something sneaky. But, yeah, I don't, not Snape. Oh,
so if it isn't Snape, then what could possibly be going on?
I have no idea. That is, when I read this, I was like, so is it Voldemort hiding in the background? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Or did somebody mess with his broom before? But I feel like that, anyway, I have no idea. I'm excited to be surprised. This is something that I read and I was just completely oblivious to what is happening.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then, so finally, it seems at least that Hermione setting Snape on fire has produced the desired effect, because Harry is able to scramble back on his broom. And you would think after such an event that he wouldn't be even thinking about winning, or like the snitch at this point.
Yeah. But he's like, he carries on, and he has the snitch. So, yeah. Which maybe I'm just a ding dong, but I feel like I was like, did I miss something? He must have grabbed it during all this chaos, apparently.
Yeah, or rather caught it in his mouth.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, the one thing I will say about the Quidditch match is just a little piece where Fred and George, once they realize that Harry is in mortal peril, like, they immediately stop doing what they're doing and are, like, circling underneath him to, like, try and catch him if he finally falls.
Good guys. The Weasley brothers.
And don't get me wrong, I adore the Weasley brothers. They are probably one of my favorite Weasleys in the whole clan. I will say, especially I think they have a lot to do with Ron's insecurities. Not because they're trying to be malicious, but I think Ron is just very sensitive and insecure, and their like sort of pranks never really have helped that. But the one thing I like about this, because we'll see it in multiple times where, again, Harry is put in certain possibly dangerous circumstances during Quidditch, and while other ones, like maybe Wood, the captain, will be like, we still have to win, we still have to win. But Fred and George, despite all their flaws, they do not have this deeply embedded sense of competition, or their pride is hanging on their identity as Quidditch players, because once they see something wrong, like, they will, like, stop what they're doing and, like, you know, help the person in mortal peril.
Yeah, they very much just, like, that's a great thing to point out, because they just have always kind of seemed like a couple of people that just want to have a good time, basically. And, you know, having somebody fall to their death is not going to result in a good time, but kind of more over that, I think I'm guessing, by having so many siblings, like, the importance of, like, care of each other might be embedded into the Weasleys as well.
Indeed. And again, it's just a nice thing that for all their flaws and how they sort of don't always help in, like, managing They have plenty of other types of egos and prides that are typical for young boys, but at the very least, the competition of sports in Quidditch is not one of them.
Right. I don't know. I really like the way their characters are kind of evolving.
So, Fred and George aside, Harry does not die, and he catches the Snitch, and they win. Yay!
Yay!
Yep, and so they go to celebrate by having tea with Hagrid, and they're trying to tell him that Snape was jinxing the broom, and Hagrid's just not having any of it. And again, even Hermione, at this point, Hermione has seen it with her own eyes at this point, so now she's like, okay, he's not just mean, he's really got it in for Harry. And then there's like, he tried to get past that three-headed dog on Halloween, it bit him, we think he was trying to steal whatever it's guarding. Hagrid dropped the teapot. How do you know about Fluffy, he said. Fluffy? Yeah, he's mine. Bought him off a Greek chappie I met in the pub last year. Bought him off a Greek chappie, again, a nod to the fact that the three-headed dog comes from Greek mythology, the Cerberus or whatever.
Oh, awesome.
In essence, Fluffy is Hagrid's.
I also just think it was really interesting, that Hagrid kind of stands up for Snape. That he kind of, you know, he's not like, oh, guy's a creep. He's just like, no, that wouldn't happen. Like, grow up, everybody. So then he's called out on the three-headed dog. And that creates a little bit of it gets Hagrid worked up. Like, he's already kind of agitated that they know about Fluffy. And then, you know, the kids keep carrying on about Snape again. Then he kind of loses it at the end. I mean, hotly. I don't imagine him like screaming, but like he seems he just is a little more curt than he typically is.
Yeah, you forget that dog and you forget what it's guarding. That's between Professor Dumbledore and Nicholas Flamel. Aha, said Harry. So there's someone called Nicholas Flamel involved, is there? Hagrid looked furious with himself.
Poor Hagrid. I love Hagrid, but he's just like, you know, I feel like sometimes people will be like, you better keep this secret. And then somebody's like, yeah, sure. And then it just comes out. I've been in meetings and with one of my coworkers who will just start saying something and I'm sitting there like cringing, like, no, don't say that. So that was kind of we've had a few instances of that with Hagrid.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, and that is the end of chapter 11. Again, pretty short chapter, but jam-packed with plot.
Yes.
And then we get chapter 12, The Mirror of Erised. And again, Christmas. What do you think of Christmas at Hogwarts?
I liked Christmas at Hogwarts. I made mashed potatoes the other night, and I hadn't made mashed potatoes in a while, and they talked about those here, and I was like, well, that's a pretty good idea to eat some mashed potatoes. But it sounds pretty fun. I like the gifts. I'll take a Weasley sweater. I'm sure we're going to go through the chapter, but this was, it was very light, you know, with the Christmas and lots of, and then it kind of, when we want to start talking about Gothic elements in Harry Potter, I was like, okay, we're starting to reveal some of those things this chapter.
Yeah. Again, just the one real annoying thing at the beginning of the chapter is Malfoy cannot find anything to criticize Harry or Ron, so he just has to revert to I'm rich and you're not.
Yeah, that always sucks. It's such a, obviously Ron is sensitive about, and Draco knows it, as bullies do. You know, they pick on the weekend, so.
Malfoy uses against both Harry and Ron. Ron from the pure, like, economic, like, financial side of it, and then tries to get Harry at it from the emotional, psychological side, like, my parents love me so much and your family doesn't.
I mean, this kid's just a little brat. Like, he obviously is a little entitled dick.
Slimeball?
Yeah. And he has his little cronies with him. I think that, and then he gives Harry a hard time for, like, it's for... He gives people a hard time that don't go home for Christmas, which honestly, when I was reading that, I was like, dude, I feel like you're kind of missing out because Hogwarts at Christmas sounds pretty great.
Yeah, like there are plenty of reasons why people don't go home for Christmas. It's not necessarily that they're unloved. Like I didn't go back home from Morocco for Christmas. I spent the whole winter break in Morocco, but not doing fun things, just shut up in my host family's house doing grad school applications.
Exactly. I mean, there are many reasons why people don't go home for Christmas. Work, you know, some people, I used to work retail, and there's just no way that, you know, that's kind of like an all hands on deck situation until 10:30 Christmas Eve night. There's no reason to kind of like chastise anybody. But these are kids, and Malfoy's a pretentious idiot.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, and actually the Weasleys, at least, you know, the Weasleys at Hogwarts are also staying because their parents are going to go visit their brother Charlie in Romania, which, you know, Romanian Christmas with dragons, that sounds so awesome.
That, I was going to say, I think if you had to pick a Christmas situation, that one would be based on one about you.
That would be a hard pass, you know. Romanian dragons or Hogwarts?
Whew. I mean, I'd go with
them. Yeah. But dragons are just so fabulous.
Exactly. That's...
Again, if I haven't already stated this, I'm a firm believer that we will eventually find the fossil of a dinosaur that could breathe fire, and therefore dragons once existed.
I listened to another silly podcast. I'm not going to mention it because it's just totally unrelated to any of this. But it was talking about ancient cultures. I don't know if that's the right words to use, and how dragons appeared in all these different types of art and whatever, and these different communities didn't communicate with each other.
Yeah, they had no, all these civilizations had no contact with each other, but they all came up with a similar thing.
So I think you're onto something, and I think that you can use this, the times you've mentioned it, to be like, see, that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. And so in between, you know, Christmas and, you know, this event with Malfoy, is they're trying to find anything they can about Nicholas Flamel, but they can't. He's not in any of the modern wizarding history books, but Harry is certain that he's heard the name before. So do you recall anything about Nicholas Flamel?
Okay, so the name's familiar, and I'm just thinking, I thought it was a poltergeist or a ghost, and I think I'm wrong. So I believe I've heard the name before. I forgot why I had heard that name before. I'm sure you know. You have a better memory than me. So where have I heard this before?
Yes, well, you'll find out soon.
Okay, thank you. Well, the next chapter, I think, is called Nicholas Flamel. So I guess I will, but...
Yeah, the restricted section of the library, like, they all think maybe Nicholas Flamel will be in there, but of course they cannot get into the restricted section unless they have a note from a teacher, and even just going anywhere near it, the librarian is like, get out of here, what are you doing?
So this is, like, where the dark magic stuff is kept, right? And some of
Like, this is the super, like, sort of dark stuff where the only reason students, like, at Hogwarts would want them is purely for, like, reference for, like, defense against the dark arts, like, the absolutely oldest students.
Okay. Well, I mean, that makes sense. Not everybody should probably taking out those books because the repercussions of learning are pretty dire.
Mm-hmm. So, and then it's funny, it's like... You will keep looking while I'm away, won't you, said Hermione, and send me an owl if you find anything. And you can ask your parents if they know who Flamel is, said Ron. It'd be safe to ask them. Very safe, as they're both dentists, said Hermione.
Yes, they have no freaking clue who Flamel is. They'll either just be like, I don't know, maybe a patient, I don't know. They're not like the long bottoms who probably did.
Yep, and then so Hermione goes away for the holidays, and Harry and Ron and the rest of the Weasleys stay, and it's a pretty sweet deal. They have the common room all to themselves. They can get close to the good armchairs by the fireplaces, eat whatever they want.
And this made me think of you, Amy, when they were talking about the empty common room. I remember that being like your happy place. And
well, it's just, again, I have this one Persian red and gold rug right next to my fireplace, and so I like to pretend I'm in the Gryffindor common room, although we actually moved that rug, so I can that's no longer my happy place with the fireplace because we moved that red and gold rug into the library, and it's nice to have in the library, but yeah.
Yeah, well, either way, roasting marshmallows and plotting to get Malfoy expelled, which just kind of made me laugh when I read that. That's all. Sounds like good fun.
Yep. And then they spend the time. Ron teaches Harry wizard chess, which is, you know, basically chess pieces that can move for themselves.
That sounds really scary because chess is not easy. And then I think this is a bit of like Harry Potter like deep knowledge that I'm not privy to. So can they make moves? Like if you move them and they change, they're like, no, I don't want to do that. Can they move on the board?
I don't know. They were describing this in the book where, you know, Ron is such a good player that his chessmen always do what he says. But Harry was like, you know, would try to move them and they would like protest, no, don't send me there. So I don't know the exact particulars.
I feel like there's a bit of a story. So, or somebody wrote about it very, very deep. I don't know. But we're almost at Christmas at this point. So that's super.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically Harry wakes on Christmas morning and he has presents for the first time. Isn't that so sad?
That's so sad and so nice that everybody, I think it was really kind of weird that he wouldn't have presents. So therefore he did. I thought that was very sweet and full of love.
And Ron is like, what did you expect, turnips?
I mean, I guess Ron doesn't really understand like the crap life Harry had before.
No, he has no freaking clue. He cannot even begin to comprehend.
So I liked his little flute that he got from Hagrid that sounds like an owl, and I would like one of those. So yeah, that's pretty
cool. So he basically gets four gifts. He gets the flute from Hagrid. He gets the sweater and the fudge from Mrs. Weasley, or like the Weasleys. I wish someone would give me homemade fudge.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. And then the and he does get like a 50 pence piece from the Dursleys.
Weird. Did they ever give him anything in the past? I don't think they did, other than like...
like a coat hanger or some stupid crap like that. Like a 50 pence, like that's not like $50. That's like 50 cents. Like it's really demeaning and they shouldn't have even done it at all. They just wanted to be petty.
I guess I was like surprised that they gave him anything at all. I guess it's like leaving a penny tip for a server or some jerk move.
Yeah. Yep. And then, but his most important gift of all is what?
The invisibility cloak. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Okay. I got called out by one of my coworkers because I said cloak of invisibility. And she said, it's invisibility cloak.
Oh, and I was no.
Like, okay. I'm sorry. I was like, I haven't got that far yet in the book. So chill.
Yep, the invisibility cloak, and there's no name. There's just a little bit of writing. Your father left this in my possession before he died. It is time it was returned to you. Use it well.
My initial assumption was Dumbledore, but I don't think I'm right. Like, I feel like I'm being deceived, and I feel like I also may not find out him that in this book.
We shall see. So he basically spends Christmas with the Weasleys, and then, again, the Christmas dinner, 100 fat roast turkeys, mountains of roast and boiled potatoes, platters of chipolatas, tureens of buttered peas, silver boats of thick, rich gravy and cranberry sauce.
Sounds pretty great.
Mm-hmm. And then a wizard crackers.
What the hell is a wizard cracker?
So the like a party cracker is like a British thing where it's like some sort of... You open it and there's some like little toy or whatever inside, but because these are wizard crackers, they have really dope things inside.
I'm such a ding dong. I thought they were like a special kind of like, I eat saltine crackers like all the time because I'm weird. And I was like, what is a, like a, is it like
okay, a yeah, cool it's saltine? A cracker as in like a fire cracker.
Like that makes, the, that makes yes, noise. Like a popper. Yeah. Okay, I got it now. So it, they were talking about food, so I was...
Have you learned nothing from the UK edition I bought you?
I have learned that I must have been hungry when I read this because I was thinking about eating crackers. That's what I was...
Although crackers, my favorite snack with crackers is crackers with a little bit of pepperoni or salami and then some Manchego cheese.
Ooh, that sounds...
And then to be really indulgent with Kalamata olives, too. And then up at the high table, Dumbledore had swapped his pointed wizard's hat for a flowered bonnet.
What is this? That is so... I highlighted that, too, because I was like, that's just so... I guess it kind of goes along with his eccentric, like, quirky
self. It's the idea that he didn't, like, decide I'm going to wear a flowered bonnet. That's what showed up in his cracker. And so he decided, a bonnet, I'll wear it.
Okay. Okay. It's still pretty goofy to, like, put that on.
Yep, and even Hagrid and McGonagall are getting drunk to where Hagrid is kissing McGonagall on the cheek and she's giggling.
Yeah, what is going on here? We got, like, Hogwarts at night happening. It's pretty wild.
Hogwarts at night. But there, I'm sure there's plenty of fan fiction devoted to Hogwarts at night.
No judgment from me.
And then it just made me think of, you know, do you remember that experience where, I don't know if it was like you saw your parents drunk for the first time or just some authority figure drunk for the first time?
Yes. That's so funny you mentioned that. I do remember my friend's parents coming home from going out and they were doing like a chicken dance in the living room. What? Oh, they're drunk. So, yeah.
Yeah. The first time I saw my mother drunk was, it was not at home. We had traveled all the way to New York because my sister was graduating from her undergrad, and it wasn't the whole big graduation ceremony. It was like the specific department dinner for all the students and their families. And my mom wasn't terribly drunk. She wasn't like belligerent or doing anything super embarrassing. She was just really like talkative and stuff like that. And her face was getting red. And finally we went to the bathroom together and I'm just kind of, you know, fake slapping her. And I'm just like, Mom, get a grip.
My mom has a tendency to drink and then pour the rest of her drink into my drink. So we were at a restaurant celebrating her birthday. And I had enough to drink and I came back to drink some water and it was full of margarita. And then my mom is like giggling at herself. So I guess her goal when she gets drunk is to get me more drunk, which she achieved.
Wait, what? So she doesn't look as drunk by comparison or what?
No, I don't handle a lot of booze very well. So she's a little sillier and I'm much more of a lightweight without being getting into the details. She's just pretty funny and is an enabler of drunkenness, I guess.
Indeed. So, yeah, and then they have snowball fights, like snack or dinner of sandwiches. And so Harry's thinking, what am I going to do with this invisibility cloak? And it's like, oh, I can go to the library. Which, again, this shows the inner bookworm of Harry, because that would what I would do if I had invisibility cloak. Go get the secret books.
That's so funny. I was like, what a little bookworm nerd. I love it. He's putting on the invisibility cloak and off to the restricted section of the library. So that sounds like a good way to use that.
Yeah, well, if we want to get into deep symbolism about the invisibility cloak, all magical items that inspire invisibility, that is making an allusion to the Ring of Gygus. Have you heard of that myth?
No, pray tell.
So the Ring of Gygus, I don't know if it was Plato who talked about it or Aristotle or, you know, basically one of those philosopher guys. They had this story about the Ring of Gygus because if you wear the Ring of Gygus, it makes you invisible. And again, this is also more so than the invisibility cloak, but the one ring in Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yeah.
The Ring of Gygus, you put it on, it makes you invisible. And so the idea is, if someone can become invisible, do they hold themselves to the same standards? Like, will they still obey the rules and the law if they are immune from culpability?
So that makes me think of The Invisible Man, obviously. My husband and I have, for the past several years, watched some Universal Monster movies in October. And this year we watched The Invisible Man week before. And basically it's a story about a guy who turns himself invisible and just does whatever the hell he wants. So direct kind of connection there as well. What decisions you would make if you weren't seen. And Harry kind of chooses a better path than like murder, which is invisible.
Yeah, or even just most kids his age.
Yeah. Yeah. He probably, like, I guess if I were, if I was thinking about a kid, like going to the like pantry and getting a bunch of cookies or not going off to the library to figure out who Nicholas Flamel is. But I like
that. And I think it just shows how, I don't know if it's like criticism of our overall education system, but the way that we structure our education system and learning, that to children's like, oh, learning is for nerds, mm-hmm. or like or eggheads or like, you know, I'm deliberately going to shun books and learning because that's what school wants me to do.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Harry is just like, this isn't about schoolwork. This is, there's the very specific thing that I'm personally invested in. I'm going to use all the resources to find out about it. So I just wish sometimes in our education system, we would allow, like, certainly there are certain tenets of literature and stuff that students should read, even though maybe they don't like this as much. But I feel like we could give more leeway in letting high schoolers and stuff like research what they want to research.
I agree 100%. I mean, I feel like I understand that restriction very much. I went to a Catholic high school. I think that's all I need to say as far as ability to research.
Oh my God. My mom has so many horror stories of the nuns from her Catholic school.
Oh man. Yeah. Thankfully I think I missed that era, but
yeah, the worst one, Sister Agnes.
That sounds like a very evil nun sort of name.
Doesn't it sound like the most evil nun on earth?
It really does. It does.
So Harry sneaks into the library, and so he's creeping in the restricted section, tries to open one of the books, and what happens? The book starts screaming.
Oh, yeah. The book starts screaming. Yes, that is terrifying.
Yeah, and some of the books in the shelves have deep blood stains on them.
So this really is quite the dark area of the library. I mean, that's like, I'm thinking about the restricted section of a library and what it would contain, and I would hope that wouldn't be this, like blood-stained screaming books. That's pretty intense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's basically, I read a recent, I don't know, it was published a few years ago, it's called Sorcery of Thorns, and it's about this girl who's basically a sort of librarian's apprentice, but it's like a magical library where, again, the books kind of can talk or, like, you know, can scream and do all sorts of things. And the whole inspiration for this book that she wrote, which I read, was the Hogwarts library and like this restricted section of these magical books.
Oh wow, that sounds really, I'm gonna have to write that title down because that sounds like a fun book to read.
Oh, I forget the author. I'll text it to you later.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and so the book starts screaming, which of course sells Harry out, and right. He only escapes detection because of his fancy invisibility cloak. You know, Filch comes, and then not just Filch comes, but then Snape comes. So Snape's already on the prowl of, like, wanting to know exactly what's going on during the school, especially at night.
Which... So that's suspect. I mean, like, I know it's intense. So it's kind of like, what are you doing? Anything better to do? Just
yeah, because the halls? Yeah, like, well, I'm, you know, Snape is the head of Slytherin House, like McGonagall's the head of Gryffindor House. So he probably has maybe a little bit more duties and responsibilities than maybe just a normal teacher who isn't the head of house. But still, like, Filch specifically goes to him.
Right. So they're like,
yeah. And they're already in cahoots because Filch was helping Snape with his leg.
Right. Right. So they're really setting some sort of dirt that they're involved with. And then good old Mrs. Norris. I don't think she's.
Mm-hmm. And then so Harry escapes by ducking into what appears to be an unused, like, old classroom. And the really interesting item within that room is this big fancy mirror,
which has an inscription carved on the top. Not you are the linguist here. I am not gonna even try. So I don't know what it says.
Erised stra eru oit ub carfru oit on wash si.
Do we learn what that means later on?
It's not a real language.
Okay, so this is just Hogwarts talk or Harry Potter talk.
Did you think about the name Erised and what the Mirror of Erised does?
I don't know what that means. I mean, I've read the chapter, but beyond it, the meaning behind Erised, I'm not sure.
What is Erised spelled backwards?
Oh, desire.
Indeed.
Okay. So I would not, never. I was convinced that it was in, like, a language. I just wasn't.
Yeah. And so the whole phrase is just, if you put it to a mirror and, you know, the spaces are out of whack, but if you read it backwards, I show not your face, but your heart's desire.
Okay. Yeah. I totally see that now because I immediately flip back to that and I'm like, there, and now I'm going to read it backwards. Huh. How clever. Okay.
Which, again, I pity the four people who had to, like, translate this into other languages to try and get all these sort of wordy puns.
Yeah, that's a good point. That would have the effect of...
Yep. And so Harry goes towards the mirror, looks into it, and what does he see?
He sees a crowd of people, which I thought was one thing, and as the chapter progressed, I realized it wasn't. I thought this was a little further in the books and kind of like the Dumbledore army. I thought it was like a preview to that. But it wasn't. It's his family.
Mm-hmm. And so in the movie, it just shows his mom and dad, which I understand for a somatic like effect, but it's not in the book. It's not just his mom and dad. It's like his whole like extended family on both sides and his maternal and paternal side.
And this is kind of like, if I'm remembering correctly, this is the first time he's seen his parents, because he kind of is seeing these people and he's like, okay, there's a bunch of people, but this woman has my eyes, and you know, and then this guy kind of looks like me. So he puts it together.
Yeah, like, yeah, we're to infer that the Dursleys are so shitty that they didn't even give him a photo of his mom,
which makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And so Harry is just like, you know, again, not as shocked as maybe typically, because he has spent a semester by now at magic school. So he just, at this point, is kind of just rolling with the punches. Oh, a mirror that shows dead people. Nice.
Right. He's just kind of like, okay, it's weird. But then he kind of gets addicted.
Yes. And then he shows Ron the mirror. And what does Ron see when he finally drags Ron there the next night?
Ron kind of sees himself as like really kind of similar to his brothers. Like, you know, he has a badge like Bill used to, and I'm holding the house cup and the Quidditch cup, and I'm Quidditch captain too. So he's seeing all himself in his mind, an admirable position, and kind of finally outshining.
Mm-hmm. And it gets to a point where, like, again, there is some sort of addictive factor of the mirror, because Ron's like, you had it all to yourself last night. Give me a bit more time. You're only holding the Quidditch cup. What's interesting about that? I want to see my parents. Don't push me. And they keep fighting with each other until Mrs. Norris shows up.
Good. I'm glad Mrs. Norris showed up and stopped that nonsense, because I was like, oh man, they're going to get into a fight with each other this early.
Yeah. And then, yeah, like Harry's like sort of listless the next day, where he doesn't want to play chess, he doesn't want to visit Hagrid. All he wants to do and think about is going back to that mirror. And even Ron, to a certain extent, can understand the sort of addictive nature of the mirror, because he does, as much as he liked what he saw, he doesn't feel the desire to go back like that as badly as Harry does.
Yeah, he doesn't have as big of a hole in his heart, whatever, mm-hmm. that Harry does. So what this reminded me of, real quick, just to relate it to real life, is I had a friend who had like a magazine cover in front of her, and there was this like very beautiful model on the cover, and she just kept staring at it, not because she was attracted to her, but because she wanted to look like her. And her mom finally said, like, if you stare at it long enough, it's not going to become true. It's just a image, you know, on the cover of magazines. Like, you know, Ron seems to get that a little bit more, and maybe it's just his exposure to the magic world more over Harry.
Yeah, well, when the person said, like, it's not going to come true, did they mean it as in, like, the person looking at it, it'll never look that good, or that just image won't come true because that's Photoshop, that doesn't in any way show the reality of most women?
It was not, you know, that I don't think they were thinking that deeply into it. It was mainly like, you know, you're not just going to stare at this photo so long that you just become her. You know, you don't have this, I don't know what, I don't remember what exactly she looked like, but not like my friend. And so, you know, I thought it was kind of interesting that my friend even told me that. She's like, yeah, my mom just told me to stop staring at it because I'm not going to like become this woman. And I was like, well, that's kind of sad, but she's also right. So I don't know. To me, there's a little bit of homophobia in that probably as well. But just things, you know, known in the future. But it reminded me of seeing something or yourself as, you know, something, and you just kind of get addicted to it. It reminded me, and I'm sure you will know, isn't there like a, who's the mythical figure that couldn't stop staring at their own reflection?
Narcissus.
Yes, Narcissus. Okay.
After learning the myth of Narcissus, I realized that there's a flower named after him because the flower sort of droops. And I'm like, oh, what does the flower look like? And so I looked up the flower Narcissus, and I'm thinking it's going to be very elegant and like an orchid or something. But in actuality, the common name for a Narcissus flower is the daffodil.
Mmm.
Which makes sense because they do kind of droop.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like somebody looking. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So Harry goes for the third time, again by himself, and he's not alone. So, back again, Harry. And it's Dumbledore.
Love a Dumbledore appearance. And I love this. This gives us a fantastic Harry Potter quote, kind of coming down the line. But I appreciated his, what does he say? Strange how nearsighted and invisible, said Dumbledore. And Harry was relieved that he was smiling.
Yeah. You, like hundreds before you, had discovered the delights of the Mirror of Erised. I didn't know it was called that, sir. But I expect you've realized by now what it does.
Well, it shows me my family. And it showed your friend Ron himself as head boy. How did you know?
I don't and need then a cloak to be visible.
I thought that was like what the kids call a major flex by Dumbledore.
Oh, a flex, yeah.
Yeah.
Let me explain. The happiest man on earth would be able to use the Mirror of Erised like a normal mirror. That is, he would look into it and see himself exactly as he is. Does that help? It shows us what we want, whatever we want. Yes and no, said Dumbledore quietly. It shows us nothing more or less than the deepest, most desperate desire of our hearts. You, who have never known your family, see them standing around you. Ronald Weasley, who has always been overshadowed by his brothers, sees himself standing alone, the best of all of them. However, this mirror will give us neither knowledge or truth. Men have wasted away before it, entranced by what they have seen, or been driven mad, not knowing if what it shows is real or even possible.
Then he's going to boot the mirror out of the room. But I think you were about to say something.
Yeah, no, it's just, you know, he asks Harry, like, you know, now you know what it is, and you'll be prepared if you ever see it again. And Harry asks, what do you see in the mirror, sir? I see myself holding a pair of thick woolen socks. Harry stared. One can never have enough socks, said Dumbledore. Another Christmas has come and gone, and I didn't get a single pair. People will insist on giving me books. It was only when he was back in bed that it struck Harry that Dumbledore might not have been quite truthful. But then, he thought as he shoved Scabbers off his pillow, it had been quite a personal question.
Good for Harry for being realized that maybe that was a little personal. If I'm going to get not too deep, but I'm just going to assume some things that I have heard about Dumbledore, there may have been a particular individual that he sees in that mirror. I don't know. But also there's nothing with wanting some socks.
Yeah, this is true, although I do prefer books.
I mean, yes, socks to books. I will take books. If all else fails, I can warm my feet with them somehow. I don't know.
It's interesting that the Mirror of Erised shows up in the first book because it is a magical object, that, again, that philosophically is quite complex.
Well, and it's that whole exchange is really mature. You know, it's not something that it's just not very childish. And that's when I was reading that section, I thought, okay, well, this is in my mind, it was the turning of a little bit more darkness in the story. Just kind of just this human psychology of kind of being enamored with an ideal self. That it was interesting.
Yeah. And then one thing I thought about again, when he was explaining his like sort of hint to Harry, like the happiest man on earth could use this mirror as a normal mirror and see himself exactly as he is. And I find myself questioning that, because even, let's say, the happiest man on earth, he may be the happiest as a superlative compared to other people, but that doesn't mean if he looked in the mirror, there's still something that he wants that he doesn't have.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, like, if that does... I would like to meet this person. I feel like somebody always wants something. If somebody's very content with their life, that's interesting.
Yeah. And then I started thinking about this because a few weeks ago I was just sitting at home on my red and gold carpet by the fireplace. I was eating some like bread with like that garlic and herb alouette type stuff. It was so good.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there by the fire with my husband, with my cats, a feeling just of contentment, you know, came within me, and just me and myself thinking that even though life isn't perfect, you know, even if there are still certain battles with like my moving forward, my career that I'm gonna have, overall, like I'm pretty content in this moment. So for like 30 seconds, if the mirror of Erised had been in my house in that moment, I would have seen myself exactly as I was.
That's awesome. I think that's what life is all about, moments of contentment.
Again, but that human nature is to always want more. So literally that would have lasted 30 seconds.
Yes. And that's okay. I mean, we've got to have some sort of motivation. Not necessarily for like fame and wealth like that, but I think there is always a want, like I guess a happy, hungry man. I mean, everybody gets a little probably at some point be like, oh, I need, but.
Yeah. And then I think what was interesting to me, again, the comparison of what Harry sees and what Ron sees is, you know, comparing between like what's a fantasy, what legitimately cannot come true, and like a dream that possibly can come true. And the notion of what I think we discussed earlier in probably in a previous episode is like being grateful for what one has, but also, you know, there's no shame in having a little ambition, and like that balance of who is trying to say like be grateful for what you have. Is it genuinely for your psychological well-being, or is it the more powerful people who don't want you to socially move up?
Yeah, and that's gonna break my brain, because I feel like there is like truth to both things, like being content and not kind of shaking up the taking what people are very protective of, and you know, just being content kind of like in moments like with food and fire and your husband. It's I don't even know what to think about that. I've had all these conversations with my husband about some similar thing. It's a very complex thought.
I think it's just the notion of the way we interchange the words dream and goal.
Mm-hmm.
Because I forget what quote it was, but someone who basically said, you know, that a goal is basically a dream with a deadline.
Oh, yeah.
And just the idea, again, that what Dumbledore says is true, that it does... No, it does not do well to dwell on dreams and forget to live. And that's very true for a situation like Harry's, where, again, he sees his parents and there's no way that the dead are going to come back.
Right.
But for Ron, whose dream is more obtainable, like physically obtainable, possibly, you know, the idea of, you know, I would not advise, oh, just give up on that.
Right. Yeah. Like, be ambitious. Go for that. You know, if that's what you want, there's nothing wrong with that. I agree. And I think when we talk about quotes, I mean, we can talk about it. I'm going to say that I'm going to use this quote again, because I remember seeing this a lot of places. It does not do dwell to live. I think that resonated with so many things. I mean, it's, you know, I'm a bit of a person that has my head in the clouds. So I can relate to that. I kind of can take things to a point where I just get disappointed, because it's probably never going to turn out the way my ideal way. But I think Ron could probably achieve his self in that mirror if he continued to go on a path that made those things possible.
Yeah, and I think it just shows, like, certainly English is not the only language that kind of uses goal and dream interchangeably in this way, but I know at the very least in Arabic, like, dream is like halam, which is like the dream that you sleep, but the goal is hadaf, that's the word for it. And you can't really mix those two together like the way you can in English and then maybe some romance languages. It's just not a thing.
That would be nice for us English speakers to kind of have that differentiation between the two.
Anyway, so do you have any idea what you would see if you were in front of the mirror of Erised?
I had a feeling you were going to ask me this question. I really did. And I'm like, do I take the like Dumbledore answer and say warm socks? I don't know. I don't know. I mean, probably in a different career, sure. Other aspects I'm content with, but that would be mine. Just on the fly, knowing you would ask that, being interrupted by work while I pondered it. Is there something that you think you would see?
I think I would see myself holding a novel that I'd written that was on the New York Times bestseller list.
I think that's awesome. And I think it'll happen. So I think you are. Yes. I'm excited for it. I love talking to my writer for their books. Yeah. Very attainable.
Alrighty then. And I think now we can move on to Gothic Geek Out. So yeah, you said chapter 12 really took a turn for that sort of stuff. So elaborate.
I did. I think that just, you know, one of the books that we are going to talk about on the next season of Sublimely Gothic is A Picture of Dorian Gray. And I have not read it yet. I know you read it this past week. But the mirror kind of made me think of, you know, a little bit of what I know that of that book. So automatically a little gothic. I know it's kind of a different, the painting reflects something totally different, but, but just kind of that like reflected image, not just because of it was a mirror, but just an altered.
It's the idea that the painting in Dorian Gray and the mirror, it does not show, even though they're representing totally different things, they share the quality of they're not reflecting the physical appearance. They're reflecting something internal.
Yes, very much so. Something that is beyond a true mirror. The cool part of the library, I forget the definitive name of it right now, just the restricted section. Yeah, I thought it had a fancier name than that, I guess. In the bloodstained books and the yelling, the book that opens and it's screaming, it kind of for some reason reminded me of Hocus Pocus, the Disney movie. That's, you know, I think a good dark library is something that often is in the Gothic. And I mean, there wasn't to me much in the Quidditch chapter that was particularly Gothic-y.
No, not at all.
Yeah. The flame, the blue flame, but that to me was more, that just reminded me of Game of Thrones. It didn't really remind me of. Were some gothic elements that you
missed? Yeah, well, again, I'm in total agreement with you. Like, just the mirror of Erised, because just mirrors. The idea of, you know, seeing something, seeing, like, the ghost in the mirror, but it's not, you can see it in the mirror, but it's you can't see it, like, when you turn behind you, or, you know, oh, there's that movie about that, like, black mirror and these two children, like, one of them got, like, institutionalized because he thought something crazy happened with the mirror, and he finally gets out and realizes that his sister, who was not institutionalized, has spent the whole, like, time he's been in there trying to convince, to get proof that the mirror is haunted while he's been trying to, like, rid himself of those delusions.
Whoa, this sounds like a really dark movie, but
it's a super dark movie, but I'm just saying, mirrors... Yeah. And them showing not purely the physical world, but some element of whether it's the shitty part of your soul or someone else or ghost or like, again, mirror is a big thing.
Yeah, I'm going to prefer this mirror to the one that shows the shitty part of my soul. I don't want to see that. Thank you.
And then, again, the haunted library, like, just the idea of these books, like, you can hear the whispers, like, between them. It's like, why is this little kid in here? He's not supposed to be in here. You're going to start screaming.
Yeah, that's terrifying. Kind of fun, but also terrifying.
Filch again, creepy groundskeeper, snooping about. Snape, who, again, very gothic.
Very gothic, yes.
So, two very gothic characters chasing down our protagonist from the creepy gothic library. Till he ends up in front of the gothic mirror.
That's why I'm so intrigued by this book that you mentioned that is based around that, because I feel like it's a very, I like that gothic-y setting, and it's it just expands on that, and that's really cool.
Yep. Alrighty then. Again, pretty self-explanatory for this, for chapter 12, but now we can move on to quotes. We talked about a lot of them because you just have to talk about them when you talk about the Mirror of Erised. One quote that we didn't delve in too much that I really liked is, "However, this mirror will give us neither knowledge or truth. Men have wasted away before it, entranced by what they have seen, or been driven mad, not knowing if what it shows is real or even possible." And just that completely showing, again, the dangerous longing of human nature.
Well, it's kind of funny because, I mean, it's men have wasted away before it, entranced by what they've seen or what you just read. It's not going to be real or possible at all if all you're doing is sitting in front of this damn mirror. So it's kind of like if Ron was super enamored with his, you know, image that he's seeing, and then he just kind of came and sat in front of that mirror every night, that's not going to, nothing's going to come of that. You know, maybe it's a source of inspiration and motivation. That's what's good for. But it's just kind of sad that some people have wasted away.
And you know what? You know what that makes me think of? It makes me think of people who have fallen for like catfish scams and romance scams online.
Yeah.
And the idea that, you know, you'll talk to them and they basically, there are some of them who are just really, really delusional, but there are some who kind of basically know, but they're not willing to, like, they still want to live in the, like, this little dream of theirs and don't want to put an end to the dream. So they just want to live in this fantasy world of just hoping in a way.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a really scary thing, and really, it's a reason I'm, one of many reasons I'm very grateful to be married, because that I don't have to experience the, you know, I think I remember on Facebook back in the day, I used to have all this information about like my likes and whatever. And somebody basically sent me a message. They were trying to go out with me, reading my profile back to me. Like, oh, I'm really interested in this movie. I'm like, dude, I can tell what you're doing. So it was like the stupidest catfish ever, you know, like he's just telling me what he thinks I want to hear.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting parallel to catfish.
Yeah. That made me think of, I went on a date with a guy, like Facebook stalking me to the point of like talking about an element of my profile that I didn't specifically talk to him about. And I'm just like, oh, that's creepy.
Yeah, it. I think some people think it comes off as like, oh, I'm showing you I'm interested. But in reality, it's kind of like, dude, no.
Well, it's just super. You just wait for them to tell you what they like.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, of all the quotes of Whitney or Erised, because there were plenty, which one struck out to you?
Well, I'm going to be a cliche. And I know we talked about this, and this one just is too important. It does not to dwell on names and forget to live or that. I feel like that's just, it's a very strong quote to the point where I think I see bones and all kinds of things with that in particular. And I think, as we discussed previously, have a number of different meanings depending on, you know, what approach you take to it. When I think I came across it a couple years ago, it kind of helped remind me to like get out of my head and do something instead of, you know, just sitting. I'm very good at just mulling over something to the point of, you know, panic and exhaustion and anxiety. So that is why that resonated with me at the time. So when reading for the first time this chapter, I thought, I just had to knew that was going to be my quote. The Quidditch chapter, I'm just trying to even think if anything stood out. The beginning. Yeah, not really. I think it was a good thing. The point about Hermione a little bit more relaxed about breaking rules, but I don't know if I'd like put that on a throw pillow or anything. So.
No. And what you said about it does not do well to dwell on dreams and forget to live. Like that kind of makes me think of, you know, just the way I was raised by my parents. And again, my parents, you know, are great, you know, always, you know, were my cheerleaders, but they're just very goal oriented. And whenever I feel like I would have a rough time, like with life, they would just be like, all they could say to comfort me was eye on the prize, eye on the prize, eye on the prize.
Wow. Okay.
And for me, it was just like, yeah, I have ambitions, I'm working towards them. But at the same time, I should be able to enjoy life at least a little bit while I'm getting to those dreams.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I think they're just more of an old school, you know, you just pay your dues and, you know, your nose to the grindstone. And then by the end, it'll be okay. But which, not that I don't want anything handed to me and I want to work hard, but at the same time, it shouldn't be absolutely miserable.
Yeah, I think it's important to have a balance of both. I mean, I think my husband,
which is why I love the new Pixar movie Soul so much.
I haven't watched that yet. I'll have to watch that.
Oh yeah, you have to watch it. It's so good. But it's that same thing. Like, what is the meaning of life, and like balancing your ambitions with still living life. It's really good. Watch it.
I have heard a lot of good things. I trust your recommendations always, so I will.
Yeah. Okay. Alrighty then, and then we move on to fan fiction time.
Oh gosh.
Yeah, so what was your fanfic scenario?
The only thing that I could come up with is if Harry saw some different in the mirror. I know that the books are kind of this going toward this kind of discovering his parents' past and learning more about his legacy. But what if he saw himself, I don't know. It would be interesting if he saw himself like as part of the Slytherin house, not that to kind of reveal that desire that he was fighting or something like that. Just not seeing his family, but seeing something a little bit darker and conflicting.
Well, I think by going off that, like seeing something maybe not exactly Slytherin, but something kind of similar to Ron is, again, I think, you know, to a certain extent, Harry has this inferiority complex where he's famous for something that he didn't like work hard for. And so for him, wanting to prove himself, like that desire in him wanting to be famous for stuff that he did, not for things that happened to him.
That's an excellent understand
because if I want to get really personal, you know that my husband's ex-girlfriend was cyber bullying and cyber stalking us for a while.
Right.
And I did used to have a blog where finally after like 2 years or 3 years of her not letting up, I finally started like pushing back and like writing about the stuff she had done to us.
Oh my gosh.
And it had the desired effect that she kind of shut up because there's only two things in life she fears, which is the fear of her image and fear of legal authority. And I don't regret writing them when I did. I felt like they served their purpose. But then afterwards, when she finally kind of went away and like dissolved into the woodwork and I started writing like just my own creative stuff, I took that website down, and not because I'm embarrassed or ashamed of anything I wrote because I told the truth. I was just thinking like when I move forward, like with publishing my poetry books and stuff, I was just like, I don't want to be known as this crazy lady's victim. I just want to be known for my writings.
Yeah, I think that makes good sense. You got what you need to get done, then pissed off. And then now you can look at others.
So yeah, so I can empathize with that element of Harry in that scenario of, you know, just having a more selfish desire to just be known for like stuff that he has control over.
Yeah. So what was your scenario?
My scenario was, what if Harry had been able to look into some of the books of the restricted section without them screaming?
Ooh. That's a fun thing to think about. Do you think he would have gone like full dark wizard right
maybe
there? Not, he would have been like, this
maybe
is so
not
cool.
Full dark wizard, but I felt like he would have maybe dabbled in things that maybe he shouldn't have, or maybe just used the certain things as a tool in a Machiavellian way to get certain things done.
I feel like also Hermione would have been so pissed because like he had exposure to something that was like, I mean, maybe she would have been excited for him. I don't know. But I think she would be a little envious that he kind of knew these things.
He could have knowledge that she couldn't.
Yes, exactly.
So I think she would be a little jealous. Yeah. Alrighty then. And that concludes episode 6 of The Rambling Raven Pups. Tune in next time where we will cover chapter 13, Nicholas Flamel, and chapter 14, Norbert the Norwegian Ridgeback. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.